Welcome to MoMA this afternoon. My name is Kelly Sibley. I'm a lecturer here at the museum, and I'm really delighted to be talking about Andy Warhol today, which is one of my most favorite topics. The talk is titled Andy Warhol, Commerce and Pop, 1950 to 1968. I've given it those date brackets for a variety of reasons. Both of those dates represent major turning points in Warhol's life. In 1950, he finished undergraduate program studying applied arts, graphic arts, and moved to New York. 1968 is also a very important year for him because he had gone through a near-death experience when he was shot by Valerie Solanas in his factory office environment. But in the ensuing 18 years between there, we see a lot of things that are similar between the 1950s era and his 1960s era, even though oftentimes in art historical literature, we want to parse out those two decades as very different. Many times we find Warhol referred to as a commercial artist in the 1950s and then as a pop artist or a fine artist in the 1960s. I think there's much more crossover and conversations happening between his work, so that's what we'll be looking at today. I'm starting you with a photograph of Warhol and kind of a very quintessential image from the 1960s. This is a 1964 photograph by Ken Heyman, who was producing and making images for a book on pop art that came out the next year. We see Warhol in his mid-30s, seated in his silver-lined factory. He's actually in the bathroom of the factory, seated on top of the toilet, and he's posed here in his very kind of blasé, blank expression with his sunglasses on, so we can't even really get a sense of his expression. I'll leave this up for a minute. I want to actually begin with a quote from an interview that he did just about this time in 1964. The interviewer asks Warhol, "Where were you last employed?" And he responds, "I Miller's Shoe Salon." Interviewer says, "What is your profession?" He replies, "Factory owner." "Do you have a secret profession?" "Commercial artist." I think this is very telling that Warhol is still calling himself a commercial artist in the mid-1960s when he's already really made a name for himself as a pop artist. This is after he's done Campbell's, Marilyn, his Death and Disaster paintings. Even though he's being discussed more in a gallery museum context, he really gets the idea that all art, to a certain extent, is a saleable product and that he is a producer of a product. But let's go back and begin with a very early image of Warhol. This is a photo from the very early 1950s. At this point, Warhol has left his hometown of Pittsburgh, where he was born. He went to Carnegie Tech for his undergrad. And it has to be noted that he did study art, but he really studied applied kind of graphic design art. At this point in time in America, the idea of the MFA or the fine arts program as we might think of it today did not exist in the numbers that you can now study at universities in this country. Most artists were being trained to do graphic design work, essentially work that could earn them money and serve as a true paying profession. So while he always had an interest in drawing and painting, he came out of college as a graphic artist. So he's made his way to New York. You see him walking down a city street wearing this kind of rumpled suit that he would often put on when he was going out to make his rounds with art directors and such to pick up jobs or deliver things that he had recently completed. He even has his portfolio underneath his arm. He's looking, I think, particularly kind of nerdy and skinny and young. And you'll even notice that he hasn't started wearing his wig yet. His hairline is really starting to recede already at this point when he's 19, when he's probably like 22, 23. He hasn't kind of taken that quintessential Warhol look with the wig and the sunglasses and such. But I think it's important to see him out and about on his professional duties. Then on the opposite extreme, I'm showing you a photograph from 1969 by the famed portrait photographer Richard Avedon. This was one of the first photographic series made of Warhol after the shooting. Avedon did this particular sitting in August of 69. You see Warhol's look clearly transformed, but here I think he's also pulling up his shirt and giving us a full frontal view of the trauma that he's experienced. And we'll come back to this idea of both a physical and maybe an artistic and personal transformation later on in the lecture. And another early image. This is an unknown photographer who took a shot of Warhol when he was still in college. He was working for the Horns department store as a way to earn some extra money while he was an undergrad. This dates from about 1947. What you see here is Warhol serving as a display assistant for the department store. I grew up in the Midwest, and I remember Horns when I was a kid. I think it got bought out by Federated or Macy's sometime in the last 10 years or so, but it was a very well-known store, kind of upscale. What you see is Warhol's own hand here with a paintbrush. Maybe he's doing a background design for one of the windows or store displays. And then this is a mannequin's arm that somebody has cheekily posed with him. So I think there's a certain setup going on here. But it's a nice document of the idea that he was, from a very early age, in the world of making commercial designs and interiors for showing off marketable goods. This is a very early page from the magazine Interiors, the June 1951 contributors page. We see Warhol's photo up here because he had indeed been doing graphic design for the magazine, and we were even given a sample of one of his recent works for the magazine in the lower corner. And again, a very young, early photograph of him, but also shows you that he, almost from the moment he arrived in New York, was able to get commercial work and became very successful very quickly. Other examples of the kind of commercial things he would have been doing in the 50s and early 60s include here on the right side a book jacket cover for a title called A Crime Club Book, Pistols by Aaron Mark Stein. This was a 1951 publication from Doubleday. And again, we oftentimes think that he's left this kind of work behind in the 1960s. But on the left, you see another work, a 1961 publication by New Directions called The Adventures of Maude Noakes. I think this one's particularly interesting because you see he's used this stamp of a face that he's repeated in a somewhat orderly fashion across the front and back of the book cover. And you will also see him start to use this kind of stamp when he's making his first series of Campbell soup cans, for instance. He uses a fleur-de-lis stamper around the bottom edge of each of the can designs. So there's this crossover, I think, both in the idea of the repetition as well as the art process. This is a fairly early business card or little advertisement that Warhol made for himself, dating from about 1953 to 54. It's a very simple design. I think it shows the elegance of his hand, gives his name, his apartment at this point in time. He was living on Lexington Avenue in the 30s. He very punnily says Murray Hell instead of Murray Hill. This is something he often does when he's writing his address in the 1950s. Gives us his advertising rep name here, Fritzy Miller, and her phone contact, and this kind of delightful, whimsical little sketch of a butterfly in the corner. But he understood how to market himself. I think that was one reason why he did gain so much ground as a commercial designer. And it should be also mentioned that by May 1952, after really working in this world for about 2 years, he won the Art Directors Club Award for Best Newspaper Artwork of that year for a CBS radio campaign. Let's go on and look at a slightly later business card advertisement. I love this because you see that he's using the same general outline of this woman, but by being able to print her body multiple times, he can fill it in different ways depending on the context and the use. These works are from about 1955. On the image on the left, you see that again, he's giving us his information, his contacts, and he would have sent these out for, I guess, self-promotion. And these are actually quite large. They measure probably about 2 feet high, so these aren't diminutive by any means. They really hold their own. But he's used the same view of the woman on the right in a much more kind of colorful facility. He's actually given a red tone to her bustier and her little pantaloons and her hat. in this version, he's given us lots of little colors and designs and symbols on the body, whereas the version that's much more of a self-promotional device, he's incorporated all of these logos of very well-known corporations and businesses. You might be able to make out a few. For instance, you'll see Chanel number 5. I think this is the I logo for, is it NBC or CBS? I forget. The Greyhound motif. And she's literally littered with all of these advertising images. So I think you gather that Warhol really understood the potency of whittling down a company or an idea's product image to one specific symbol. Perhaps one of Warhol's best well-known commercial products that spanned about a 5-year chunk of time is his I. Miller shoe company advertisements. This is one that he had done for the spring collection. I think you see that there is a certain crispness that you get in these printed advertisements that you don't see in some of the other drawings. They were meant to be very visually appealing, but simple and easily readable. They would have appeared on a weekly basis in what was kind of the equivalent of the Sunday Style section in now today's New York Times. And he did these up to about 1959. What I'm going to show you next is how he continues to use the same motif of the shoe or the foot, but for slightly different reasons and in slightly different visual languages. This is a work on paper, a print actually, that's in the collection of MoMA. He had done a whole book or portfolio of these shoe drawings that was titled A la recherche du shoe perdu, which is a play on Proust's title, In Remembrance of Lost Time. Underneath each of the various images of the shoes, there's some kind of textual component that was written by his friend Ralph Pomeroy. These were all made about 1955. We're not sure how many copies, how many editions of these prints that he did, but the shoe outline themselves would have been a lithograph, and then all of the colors were hand done with a Dr. Martin's kind of watercolor dye. The phrases themselves are quite punny and funny and lighthearted. He would have used these kind of things as promotional materials. Yet again, he would have handed these out as gifts to art directors as kind of a way of greasing people up and keeping him in their memory as they come forward with new projects for him. This is just another version, again, of one of the prints from that portfolio. Should be noted that at the same time, he also had a show at the Bodley Gallery, 1956, which was a very small, not particularly well-known gallery. His show was titled Andy Warhol, The Golden Slipper Show, or Shoes Shoe in America. So you see him also using these kind of things in, again, a more fine art context, a formal gallery where things are framed and hung on the wall and are available for sale. So he seems to be having his hands in multiple pots, if you will. He's making these kind of shoe images for newspapers. He's doing them more for promotional purposes in his business life, and he's also making them for a gallery clientele. And I think one of the best illustrations of his very personal work at this moment is a line drawing from about 1958. In this case, the shoe has been abandoned. Now we just see this still life he set up with a man's foot against this background. We'll save the whole discussion of Warhol's foot or shoe fetish for another day, but in this kind of work, you see him really making something that wasn't going to be made available for public consumption. And even in the kind of line he's using here, there's a real difference. It's a much more crisp, assured line, whereas you kind of get these wobbles and blurs in some of the images that we had just seen. It comes down to a difference of method. This is oftentimes referred to as his blotted line method, whereas the drawings, this one's made with ballpoint pen on paper, have a certain, I think, crispness to them that you don't see in the other work. Where Warhol displayed his work, both commercial and fine, during the 1950s is a fascinating topic. I'm showing you a display window that would have been on the street for the Bonwit Teller department store, which used to be located on 57th and 5th Avenue, which is really prime real estate, shopping real estate, browsing real estate, walking real estate. For many years in the 50s, Warhol was doing wind displays for them periodically, as were other artists like Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg. The difference was most other artists were quite sheepish about the fact that they were doing this sort of thing. They were doing it really to pay the bills, not because they considered it to be their full-time profession. Whereas Warhol was much more blatant and open about it. What I like about this particular photograph from 1956 is that we see, you know, the expected mannequin posed with maybe a spring or summer dress that was available inside the store. But we also see this sequence of framed work by Warhol that hangs behind her. Unfortunately, the documentary photos of this window display are not very good, and I have not been able to make out exactly what is in these frames. But we do know that, for instance, in the windows adjacent to this display, Jasper Johns showed one of his early white flag versions. So there were other artists that were, I think, also merging this idea of high art, their gallery productions, with the commercial side of Bonwit Teller's business. I know many of you as New Yorkers know and love the restaurant and ice cream parlor Serendipity, which had been established, pardon me for not remembering the year, but sometime in the 1950s, and Warhol had really taken it as a personal favorite hangout, and almost workspace in many ways. This is a photograph by John Ordoin from 1961. We see Warhol posed in front of the stupa of the store. It's now on 60th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. I think it has moved around a little bit over the years, but it was always around 60th Street, maybe a couple blocks north or south of there. But Warhol would oftentimes meet up with friends and kind of co-workers at Serendipity. He would persuade people to help him color in some of those shoe brochures that we had looked at. Other people would actually put in the watercolor paint sometime. And Serendipity would also let him hang his work within the restaurant on the walls, and he did occasionally sell his work in the 50s and early 60s from people that came in for an ice cream sundae or such. So I think we see a real flexibility in the way he's thinking about spaces where he can exhibit his work. So around 1960, we do see a whole new era come into being with his work. In 60, 61, early 62, he's really moving through a series of motifs that we might consider his earliest pop paintings. Interestingly, he's choosing advertisements that he then blows up into large-scale paintings. Here you see a 1961 painting called Water Heater, which is about 45 by 40 inches. And you'll see that he's taken the water heater, certain information, the fact that it costs $55, it's a 10-year tank guarantee, etc. But we also see him blanking areas out. It might be hard for you to see, but there's a body of white on the left side as well as the bottom where he was testing out information and then erased it. So we see him really playing with how much of an image does he need to give. We also see him choosing advertisements that are much more kind of low-level, scrappy, basic than anything he ever produced. You know, he's making these elegant designs for fancy shoe stores, or doing graphic layouts for Harper's Bazaar magazine showing the most popular women's cocktail rings at the moment. He's never making kind of back of the throwaway newspaper, black and white, crinkly, 1-inch by 2-inch square advertisements. But that's what he chooses to use as his base images when he begins the paintings. This is actually a work on paper, but in the same vein. From 1960 or thereabouts, it is titled Bald, and you see both graphite and some acrylic paint on paper. In this case, he's looking at an advertisement for appealing to men who have hair loss, which is interesting in light of his own, I think, issues and problems and sensitivities to going bald at an early age. He had started to wear a wig by the mid-1950s, and he really plays up the image of the wig. As he moves through the 60s, it becomes more and more extreme and artificial. So I think there's a bit of a tie-in into his own personal interests or woes. We'll get there, I promise. Here you see an advertisement for a wig within this, a wig store within this particular page, again from a cheap publication. he uses that section as, again, the basis for this large-scale painting from about 1960. I think it's interesting to see the source in light of the painting here, because you get a sense of how much information he's decided not to actually put into the painting. Essentially, no text. He selects certain images and leaves out others. Some areas of the black color are kind of unreadable in the way he's put them down on the painting. And also notice all of these drips. His line in the paintings will really tighten up within another year or so, but there seems to be this lingering messiness, almost a certain regard for abstract expressionism and the gesture and the drip that you might see in somebody like Jackson Pollock or William de Kooning, who are still very highly regarded artists at the turn into the 1960s. And just one last one. This is the source image for a series of paintings called Before and After that he was making in 1961. He had also, in addition to wearing his wig from the 50s, had gone under some kind of nose alteration, whether it was a full nose job or a nose scraping. We're not quite sure. He was always very private about this matter. But I think what you're gathering is that he was a somewhat self-conscious and uncomfortable person with his own physical state, which becomes very interesting when he's willing to put his physical body on such display during the 60s. So there's the source material. This is the first painting he made in the series from about April of 1961. Still a lot of these drips. There's a kind of a certain unfinished quality to it all. And then a later state that you're now seeing on the right side of the screen from maybe a month or two later after the first version, which everything gets kind of tightened up and has much more of a graphic crispness to it. Now, the first time that he showed his pop art was actually not in a gallery context. He goes back to Bonwit Teller. He's done many window displays for him over the years. But in 1961, he does a display in April that gives us the first visual taste of the kind of paintings that he's been making. So in the background, you see the before and after come back into play. That's that first version we had looked at. We also see his Superman painting. This is a Popeye image. This is another one that's using kind of a collage of a bunch of cheap black and white advertising images. So again, of course, Bonwit Teller is paying him to make a showcase for their products, and they give us this lovely lineup of women's dresses for the day. But you know, the fact that he's searching out a venue to show this kind of work and that he has a willingness to incorporate it into one of his commercial contracts is particularly important. I know this is a terrible slide, and I do apologize, but I'm not so sorry, because these are upstairs at MoMA, and I hope you'll go up on your own and take a better look at them on the fourth floor in the painting and sculpture galleries. The 32 Campbell soup cans that he made in 1962 are usually discussed as the first time he exhibited his pop art, and that's true. These were the first pop paintings that he showed in a gallery context. He had been trying to get a show in New York for at least a year and a half before these were shown in a West Coast gallery in LA called the Ferris Gallery in July and August of 1962. This is the way you see them currently in the gallery in four rows of eight. But the way we can install them is quite interchangeable, and their positions have shifted over the years. I think it's great to see an installation photo from the Ferris Gallery. This shows that this ledge was installed all the way around the perimeter of the gallery, and then the paintings themselves were propped up on the ledge. Now he's taking one of the most recognizable advertising images, or branding images, I should say, in all of American commercial culture. The Campbell Soup Company had come into business in 1897. The first flavor they made was tomato. And they had essentially stuck with that red and white label since the conception of their product. It carried great resonance with virtually anyone in America. Everybody could recognize it. The only variations between each of the canvases in the series of 32 is the actual flavor. 32 flavors were available on the market at this point, so that's the determining factor for how many parts are in the whole series. We're not quite sure if it was Warhol's idea or his gallery's idea to use this ledge display. But it really seems to make sense in this crossover merging that he's making between his fine art aspirations and his commercial past. Each of the paintings actually rests on the ledge, at least the lower edge rests on the ledge, but then the upper edge rests against the wall, which is the traditional space where we hang, display fine artworks when we go into a gallery. So the paintings seem to operate both as painting and object, or as fine object, fine art object and commercial object all at the same time. And again, not a great slide, but this is just to give you a little bit of a sense of scale of the works in our collection. Right now, they're installed with tomato at the top corner, just because that's the first flavor chronologically, but there's no one schematic that says how we have to install these or in any particular order. At this point, Warhol's still hand-painting all the images, which is remarkable because when you first look at all of the canvases together, you get the sense that you're looking at the same painting 32 times over. They're all the same size. They're all centered on a white blank background within each of their 20-inch by 16-inch canvases. But he does remain true to a few little variations that you'll see in the labels. One of them has a little yellow banner on it, for instance, and he'll reproduce that when he actually painted them himself. You know, oftentimes critics thought that this was a real slap in the face to the way products, commodities were bought and sold in America, the idea that we are a very superficial commodity-based culture. But actually, Warhol always said that the images he chose in these early pop paintings were picked out because he liked the products, because he liked what they stood for. In something like Campbell's, he really saw American democracy and the fact that these were inexpensive products. You could buy them at virtually any grocery store in America. No matter where you were always going to get the same product. It wasn't going to be better in New York than Mississippi. Just to paraphrase, he said about Coca-Cola, they liked Coke because everybody from the President of the United States to the office secretary can enjoy a Coke, buy one, will enjoy the same Coke over and over again. So I think there's a real celebration here of the plenty, the full cupboard that speaks of American prosperity in the late 1950s and early 60s. And also to tie in this idea of how he was using the same motif but in different medias and different kinds of drawing, as we saw with the shoe drawings in the 50s, this is just a small drawing of the Campbell's can that he also made around the same time. So he's tinkering with how he's making them, whether they're painted or they're drawn, the size. He'll even give us perhaps less familiar images to us, like this big painting, which actually has a can opener attached to the top of the can. I love this photo because it's a great little documentary piece of Warhol actually in his home slash studio in April 1962. This was made by the wonderful photographer Alfred Stadler, who used to be a staff photographer for Time magazine and other periodicals and publications. He mostly worked in New York, but he really covered the art beat, and he would oftentimes photograph gallery openings, events, etc. Time had sent him to photograph Warhol in his house very early on for one of the first national articles about pop art. So here we see Warhol in his townhouse parlor floor. The townhouse was located about 89th, 90th Street on Lexington Avenue. He didn't officially have a artist studio at this point, so he was working out of his living room. And you get a sense of his willingness to participate in this documentary. He gamely holds a can of soup that he pretends to be eating. You'll see some other projects in the background. This is related to some paintings of money that he did, this large painting of an old-fashioned telephone, for instance. And let's just flip over. Another image from the same space in his house. He had been making things like the Campbells. He's starting to think about things like Marilyn Monroe later in that year. But at the same moment, he's still taking on commissions from Harper's Bazaar, for instance. And in the November 1962 issue of that publication, we're shown a series of these car silkscreen paintings that had been made for a feature presentation on automobiles in America for the magazine. But I love that all of these ostensibly commercial images are lined up or propped next to one of the images from his Coca-Cola bottle series. So there's this real mingling both in style, method, and space of all of these kinds of work that he's doing at this moment. He still needs to rely on the commercial work to make a living at this point. The pop art is not going to pay for his townhouse and all of his other obligations. And as a side note, if any of you are particularly interested in Warhol, I just saw that in last week's New York Times real estate section, Warhol's townhouse, from which this was photographed, is actually on the market. And they have kindly installed the first floor of the house with a bunch of reproductions of the work that could have been found there in the early 1960s. And I believe they're going to make it available for public view. The house has been in private hands for probably the last 10 years or so. And I know there hasn't been a lot of access available. So if you're very interested, that might be a special little thing to see in New York in the next month or two. Warhol does quickly begin to show in a variety of galleries and group shows as pop art really explodes in about 1962-63. This is a print, actually an album cover made into a print that he designed for a show that was featured at the Gallery of Modern Art in Washington, D.C. in 1963. This particular museum had a very short life, but they are known for doing one of the earliest shows on pop art, which was called The Popular Image. Warhol was asked to do the album cover for a series of interviews that the museum had done with a bunch of artists. And I love that he's made the choice to use the kind of sign you might have found in your Gristiti's or Food Emporium at this point in time. Maybe it was advertising, a special price on chickens or paper towels, I don't know. But he gives us the information, giant size, only $1.57 each. Very similar to another photo from just about this same time that again was made for some kind of publicity or article written about him in the mid-1960s. We don't know who took this photo, but here Warhol is again very willingly gone into his neighborhood Gristiti's, which was a couple blocks from his townhouse, and posed in the aisles as he pushes around a cart full of a lot of the products that again he had appropriated and made in the popping. So you get Brillo and Campbell's cans and the Coke bottles. So this brings us to his traditional portraiture that he's also making in the early 60s. I don't really think of his portraits of Marilyn or Troy Donahue or Natalie Wood or Elizabeth Taylor as very different works than things like the Campbell's cans or the Del Monte cans or the Brillo boxes, which are to come shortly. They're kind of recognizable, very popular images that speak to virtually any viewer in America. Marilyn would have been equally well known as the Campbell's label, for instance. She was chosen in late 1962 for the very specific reason that she had recently passed away in August of that year. So he's really, I think, tapping into the memorial and the sentiment of her loss when he decides to paint her. The whole series of the Marilyn portraits were shown in November of 62 in his first pop show in New York, which was at the Stable Gallery, at that point in time located on 74th Street on the east side. This is Marilyn, Gold Marilyn, which is in MoMA's collection, and again is upstairs in the fourth floor gallery. It's quite unique in the whole series because he sets her face, this particular silk screen is 20 inches high, 16 inches wide, the same dimensions as all of the individual Campbell's paintings, but he sets that silk screen off against this big gold black background, I think really to speak of reverence for her, the importance that she held in American popular culture. And with this series, he really ushers in the new era of using photo-based silk screens. You know, silk screens are nothing more than a fancy stencil that allows you to reproduce an image over and over again. And in this case, he chose a publicity still of Marilyn from a mid-1950s movie called Niagara. He cropped the publicity still down, so we're really just focusing on her face here. We don't get quite as much of the detail of her dress in the background. But, you know, he's using another image that was circulated in its own sense for the propagation of American kind of Hollywood films and movies as the basis for making this series. He'll continue, as we've seen before, to revise and slightly change these images that he's chosen. This is a print series that he did of Marilyn just a few years later, made in 1967. Now he's made the rectangular format into a square format. Each of these is about 36 by 36 inches. He's still relied, though, on the very kind of bright, artificial, candy-coated colors that we saw in the original series of paintings from 1962. And I should note, this is a great time for Warhol at MoMA, because if you go up to the sixth floor to see our special exhibition color chart, we have accumulated six of the portraits of Marilyn from 1962, which are all done in the more diminutive 20 by 16 inch size. It's very rare to see so many of them together at this point, so I really recommend at some time between now and I think November, May 12th when the show comes down, that you go up and take a look at those. Each of them is done, again, in a very artificial kinds of color that I think speak to more of her public side, or the sexual silk screen, movie star screen side of her personality, making the choice not to really focus on some elements of her personal life that have perhaps captivated our imagination since she died. I don't really have time to do lots of comparisons with other people's work, other pop work at this point, but I did want to throw in one work by Roy Lichtenstein that's being made at almost about the same time that Warhol does his Marilyn's. You know, here Lichtenstein is also working from a print ad, a sign image. This was actually, the girl with ball image was actually taken from an advertisement for a resort in the Poconos, but Lichtenstein has taken out all the textual information and just isolated this young girl holding a beach ball as an image of kind of fun, lighthearted summertime entertainment. You know, one of the main differences between how Warhol makes his pop art and some of the other artists like Lichtenstein is that he is taking branded, named images and symbols and products, whereas somebody like Lichtenstein is giving us, you know, this young woman, maybe not so different than Marilyn, but she's more of an anonymous figure. There's no, I think, personal name affiliated with the kind of image he gives us. So at the same time that Warhol is doing his Marilyn's, he's also still doing things for publications like Harper's Bazaar. In this case, he designed the cover of the autumn 1962 International Fashion Special. We see a woman in profile with these washes of watercolor that divide up the spaces of her background into different regions, blue, orange, green, etc. I've now added to the screen on the right one of, I think, the preparatory works, or the earlier versions of the cover. What I find fascinating is that when this small work on the right was exhibited at a gallery in the last few years and published in their catalog, they titled it Untitled Glamour Portrait. I don't think when you look at this in the way the gallery showed it, that you really get that it had a commercial origin, or that it was part of this whole project that he was paid by Harper's Bazaar to do. And while that in no way takes away from the interest or the beauty of that drawing that you now see, I think there is this need in the way we want to classify images, particularly with Warhol, to divide up the work into high and low. And he himself never would have actually done that in his own life. I know I'm going to run out of time in a few minutes, so I'll speed through these last few. Here you see by 1963-64, he's entered into the realm of sculpture by making these boxes that were shown in a whole exhibition devoted to them. In April of 64, this is the Heinz ketchup box. These had been constructed out of wood by a carpenter that Warhol commissioned to do the boxes, and then they were painted in silkscreen within his studio. This is just a version for the Campbell's tomato soup, or tomato juice, rather. And here is an installation photograph from the actual show at the Stable Gallery yet again. This was by Fred McDerrah, who is another wonderful chronicler of the art scene in New York, and unfortunately passed away this last year. Warhol deliberately installed this show, I think, to mimic the idea of the supermarket, of packages stacked up. You know, I'm sure we've all had the experience of going into a New York City market when the truck is unloading and you can barely make your way through the aisles to pick up your quart of milk. He's not allowing the gallery to be a very open, flowing, inviting space as he lines up all these boxes across the floor. There are other photographs that show visitors at the opening kind of gingerly trying to step around and even congregate and have their drinks because he's made it such an unwelcoming environment, actually. And another shot that shows how he stacked them up vertically, in this case that he's posing with his Brillo boxes. Actually, for this show, he returns to the idea of making advertisements for his own career, very similar to the kind of business card images that he was making in the 50s, although now he takes on a very different graphic appeal. This was an advertisement that was taken out in Art International to promote the show of the boxes that we just saw. It appeared in the April 1964 issue and features at the top, you see this photo booth shot, photo booth photo that Warhol had taken of himself. And then at the very bottom, you see this text called The Personality of the Artist that was written by a young critic and art historian named Jean Swenson, who had published in Art News one of the first series of interviews about pop art. So Swenson, in this kind of convoluted philosophical language, talks about Warhol, and then we're given the information for the gallery and such at the bottom. The really remarkable thing about this is that it was a whole page advertisement that appeared on the inside back cover. The normal way to advertise a show in most of the art periodicals in the 50s and early 60s was for the gallery to take out a 1-inch by 2-inch black and white box of text that appears in all of these long columns. It would give the name of the artist, the gallery, the dates of the show. No visuals, very hard to read because there could have been easily 30 of these advertisements on a page. The kind of glossy advertisements you now see when you crack open Artform every month really did not exist in 1962. We're not sure if Warhol paid for this advertising, if Eleanor Ward, the owner of the Stable Gallery, paid for it or partially paid for it, if he kind of cajoled her into doing this. But what we do know is that he's very much publicizing himself, and now his own individual face becomes the emblem of the Warhol brand. Another example of how he's allowing his physical, personal body to be used in an advertising context, this is a design for the Champion Paper Company that was made in 1962, and we see this dual project with Andy Warhol and another designer named Art Kane, who somebody just told me has a drawing actually in our recent drawings gallery installation, which I haven't seen yet, but it's worth checking out. So essentially, Warhol's image is made by Art Kane, and then Warhol does a drawing of Kane on the right side. But again, for somebody that was particularly self-conscious of his physical appearance, the fact that he's willing to strip off his shirt, have Kane paint his face in gold, and make a photograph of him seems like a real turning point for him in his ability to put himself, his personal self, on physical display. And just to prove that he's not leaving all of these commercial projects behind, even by the mid-1950s, this is a Time magazine cover done for the January 29th, 1965 issue, for which Warhol devised and did the graphic design for the cover. And this was a particular issue focused on today's teenagers. And here you see these photograph pictures that he collaged together to make that cover. I think these were all children of Time Life employees at that point. And finally, we'll wrap up with a couple last images of him. This is one of his self-portraits that he actually did on canvas from about spring of 1964. The base image for this, the source image, is yet another photo booth picture that he shot of himself. Very interesting, almost kind of similar pink face that he had used for his Marilyns. Very kind of austere image, his chin slightly up in the air, direct gaze at us. And then perhaps the most famous series of self-portraits that he makes in 1966-67, which ends up becoming the real emblem of Warhol for the 1960s and beyond. This one is based on another person's photograph of him as he held his hand up to his mouth. This series is actually in MoMA's collection as well, and you see the same basic silk screen done in a variety of different colors over this 9-tiled grid. He comes back to this image yet again of himself with the hand to mouth when he chooses the cover for his kind of tell-all tale of his work in the 60s titled Popism, the Warhol 60s. This was published in 1980 along with his secretary slash typist Pat Hackett. But at this point, Warhol's face is known around the world. I think his visual image is perhaps more well-known than many of his artworks at this point, and he's really evolved into his own brand, with no small measure, I think, to his early career as a commercial artist in the 50s. And just one last kind of, I don't know, brochure that he made. I couldn't resist this one. This was made as a kind of publicity distribution material for Warhol Films, Inc. We haven't had time to talk about it today, but he was one of the most important independent or underground filmmakers during the 60s, too. It's hard to see what this is, but this is almost kind of like a record jacket cover, and there's a turn wheel here on the side. As you turn the wheel, different visual images of his movies come up, and as each image comes up, the title of the film rotates through his mouth. But the fact that he's really using his own face as the background for all this information melds the personality of Warhol with the things that he's making. And so now we arrive at 1968. This is the cover of the Daily News on January 4th, 68, that documents the fact that he had been shot the day before. We're given that kind of the stock or slightly earlier image of Warhol. I'm not sure where it is. It might have been Max's Kansas City, where he had hung out a lot at that point in time. But he really grabs front page status with his near-death situation. And just one more photo. This is a photograph that shows him being put in the ambulance and was also reproduced in a number of the papers and magazines at this point in time. You see his wig kind of dangling sadly off to the side. He went through a very long recuperation process. He spent about 2 months in the hospital and very much changed his outlook of how his office and his studio was structured. There was a hiatus from making work before he actually went back to painting and drawing again. And you know, the earlier factory had been thought of as this very open, free-spirited environment where people were coming and going all the time. He became highly conscious of security. So at this point, when he goes back to work by the early parts of 1969, he's really closed down the doors, so to speak. There's much more of a business-like atmosphere. And while there are lots of issues floating around both the economic climate in New York, what's happening in the art world, there also seems to be a change in the kind of fine artwork that he's making. And one last image of the Richard Avedon series that we had seen. This is a slightly different version of the full facial version we had seen at the very beginning. Here, Avedon crops the picture down, so we're really just focused on the scars that line his chest. And again, his willingness to pose for something like this, I think, speaks of the everlasting change and trauma that he experienced. And again, the surprising vulnerability and willingness to show off the physical scars that he would carry with him to the rest of his life. He died in 1987, actually, of a very common gallbladder procedure, but I think he kind of put off dealing with that because of this awful experience that he had had in the 1960s. And finally, just to show you that Warhol and pop and commerce are alive and well, this is a plate that's currently being sold by Crate & Barrel 2, which is the offshoot of Crate & Barrel. They are clearly Warhol's Marilyn image that has now been applied to these great plastic plates that only cost $3.95 each. It's a bargain. The store itself is just above Canal Street on Broadway, and they're also online. You don't even have to go to the store. And the final image, this is a sheet of stamps that show Warhol's image. The U.S. Postal Service had issued this image based on his 1964 self-portrait. In 2002, these came out, and I think the 37 cents certainly dates them. But the fact that Warhol made it to his own stamp, and that again we chose his face, not a Campbell's can, not a Marilyn, as the real symbol of his work, is perhaps the best example of how he was always operating between commerce and pop. Thank you so much. I'm happy to take questions. Always. He's always at the auctions, yeah.
So I've been reading about that his family is, he didn't say in the ad, the family uses the family name, which is, I think, an extended version.
It is. His given name was Warhol with an A at the end, and he ended up dropping the A shortly after he came to New York and was doing commercial jobs. It seemed to have been a typo that the A got taken off for one of his earliest spreads, and he kind of stuck with that for the rest of his life.
So he's quite a commodity.
Absolutely. I think he surpassed Picasso last year as the highest revenue producer at auction.
Really?
I put the ad in today, but I can't find it in my bag, but he did surpass Picasso.
Yes, this past year. Yep.
Yeah. I'm into the serendipity.
Thank you all.
I'm into serendipity.